You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Ginny.
And I'm Jen.
And we are the art history babes.
And we still have our special guest, Christina, with us.
You can't get rid of me.
Never.
Hi, yes.
Mom.
Aww. Quick shout out from Nat over there.
No, Christina's mom.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
I am mother to all these children.
That's
no
true.
Offense to
the children of the world.
Christina's mom.
Mama Teresa. Mama Christina.
Our beautiful art history mom right here.
Aww. Aww. We love her.
So what have you guys been up to lately? I'm really curious to know.
You're so smooth.
You are.
Because you're so smooth.
I went to a Dave Matthews Band concert in San Diego.
Yeah.
Crash into me.
Yeah. It was great because, like, we were both, like, we were there ironically and not at all because I fucking love Dave Matthews.
Yeah.
And it was, like, the most fun I've ever had. So if you ever have the opportunity to get drunk at a Dave Matthews Band concert, do not pass that shit up. Sure. It's so much fun.
Did he empty out the contents of his tour bus septic tank?
Oh, I forgot about that one time.
He did that?
Yeah,
that
over a bridge, and it rained on people.
Yeah. Oh, God damn it, Dave. You fucking weirdo.
Sorry, Dave. I know that you're...
Oh, wait. Was that Dave?
I don't
know.
Yeah,
dude.
Was it Dave?
Was it Hootie and the Blowfish?
Was it Hootie?
I don't know. Wait, was that
Hootie? We'll have our fact checker check it later.
Hey, Dave, if that wasn't you, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Dave. Our bad.
Wait, I'm the fact checker.
Jenny, what have you been?
Not a whole lot. I went to a Japanese tea garden in Saratoga, California.
Wow.
Called Hakone. And it's like 18 acres, and the architecture was dope. I love architecture, especially like Japanese architecture.
Yes.
So cool.
Pagodas.
anyways. It was really cool. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I try to go to a lot of Japanese tea gardens, which isn't always the easiest thing to do in the States. I eventually will get to Japan.
Yeah. Will you take me to a Japanese tea garden?
I would love to.
I
so
go.
Far, my favorite one, and this is like to anyone who's like interested or into it or whatever, my favorite Japanese tea garden is the one in Portland. It's the only one in Portland, small city.
Ooh.
But it's beautiful. And Hakone is beautiful as well, but like the one in Portland just has a little special place in my heart.
Could do an art history babe trip. Ooh. To a Japanese tea garden.
Yeah.
Yes.
We out here at the Japanese
tea garden. Oh, yeah. We need
sit
to do
by
more
the
of those.
Koi fish pond.
Yeah.
Koi fish.
Be delightful.
Jen, what have you been up to?
Oh, so it's been really fun, you guys. So what have I been up to? I've been working 40 hours a week at a toxicology lab in a rural town, okay? And I check to make sure that you guys aren't eating poisonous vegetables. It's been really fun. Besides that, I've been rearranging my apartment. I've been watching sad movies. I've also been having little personal parties where I blast James Brown. It's really fun. And that's kind of about it. But this weekend, I'm going to go see Santana with my dad in San Francisco, California.
So you have such a rich life.
I love my pop, and we're going to be out there.
Shout out to pop.
And we're going
to
be like,
pop.
Give me your heart, make it real, or let's forget about it.
Yes! Forget about it.
Oh, it's so great.
Oh my god.
So that's what we've been doing. But yeah, so we're doing part two of our episode on architecture and power. And if you listen to the first episode, I left you in a little bit of a cliffhanger after our just tearing into Corbu for
Cordouche.
Cordouche.
Hashtag Cordouche.
But yeah, so we left you. Corbu met up with Mussolini and in 1934, and Ginny's got some things to say about that.
Oh God, we're just like moving from one asshole to another. But the thing is, Mussolini was a lot more stupid.
You're so kind, Ginny. You're so kind,
Corbu. But okay, so Mussolini. Benito Mussolini, Italian, kind of orchestrates the beginning of the fascist movement. And so the fascists in Italy really regarded their rise to power as a revolution. And the fascist revolution was, you know, the marking of it was them marching on Rome, because Rome is really like the center of power for Italy. And so they marked the beginning of their revolution from that day in the 20s when they marched on Rome and kind of seized power. And understandably, you have a new government, you have a new source of power, they're fascists, they need to have a sort of artistic and architectural style that is going to mark their movement. And here's where it gets a little confusing, as it does many times with dictators, because they're really kind of hodgepodge, kind of slapping in different elements of things because they don't know what they're doing. But anyways, so the fascists, as it pertains to architecture, there was no clear architectural style for the fascist movement. The futurist architects were very much integral to this, and Mussolini did make a stance that, like, modern architecture is revolutionary, and we are revolutionary because, again, like, the fascists really wanted to promote this sense of, like, a fascist revolution. And they were really influenced by, like, the revolution in Russia and the communists, but they wanted to separate themselves from them. So this brings about, like, this beginning of this weird hybrid of different styles, because on the one side, Mussolini and the fascists were like, yes, modern architecture, it's great, it's cool, it's what we're all about. But on the other hand, Mussolini really wanted to tap into ancient Rome. And he wanted to do this for kind of a variety of reasons. The main one was that, you know, there was an undisputed kind of legacy of power with ancient Rome, particularly the emperors of ancient Rome. So Mussolini wanted to tap into this ancient Roman imperial kind of visual rhetoric and bring that back with a fascist regime. And he did this by likening himself to the Emperor Augustus and saying, hey, with me and with the fascist control, it's like saying fascist a lot of times makes
pretty
more
hard. It's like a tongue twister
in my mouth.
Fascist. Yeah,
it's a spit creator. So this is what the fascist regime started doing, where they were going about this kind of cleansing of Italy and making rebirth of the Roman Empire through this new modern fascist lens.
It's interesting that you talk about fascism in ancient Rome, because as a sort of ancient art historian...
Tell me, Christina.
I will tell you. it's kind of interesting because one of the big sort of monuments of ancient Rome is the Areopagus, which was one of the mausoleums to the Pax Romana that Augustus instated in the early, sort of the turn of the millennium.
Right.
But what is interesting that is that Mussolini, when he came into power... literally picked up the Areopagus and moved it like a mile towards the river.
Yeah.
Picked it up piece by piece and transported it and put it in a new place.
Yeah. where it is now when you go by the Tiber River. That's not what it originally was.
That's what I would do if I was the dictator of Italy. If I was El Duce.
If you are El Duce, you can pick up a monument and move it wherever you want to suit whatever interest,
you own
political
history
interest you want.
Now.
Yeah. And he did it so that it would be closer to the mausoleum where Augustus was buried to sort of create a connection between him and Augustus.
Was he a short man?
He was a shorter man.
But he was well-muscled.
Yes. Well-muscled.
He had that small dog syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That Napoleon complex.
Yeah.
He is a real weird dude. Like, when talking about, like, Winckelmann and this kind of obsession with white marble and, like, Carrara marble in particular, this really has a resurgence with Mussolini where he's, like,
reclaiming the ancient Roman past.
In multiple ways.
Yeah, it's, like, reaffirmation of we are the sort of rebirth of this great, great, great Roman Empire.
And it's our birthright because we have inherited this kind of glorious past.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's going into the quarries in Carrara and bringing back all this mass amount of marble to start constructing all of these various monuments and buildings and complexes to really kind of stabilize Rome as this center that is both historically powerful and important, but is also a new center of fascist Italian power. And he did this in a variety of ways. And I'll only talk about a couple of the complexes that he made. And like, if you go to Rome today, Mussolini is everywhere.
And they're what's interesting is they're mostly on the outskirts of Rome.
Yes.
They're not in the historic city center. They're on the sort of the more residential outskirts, like Garbatella. If you ever go to Garbatella, that is a very residential area, very steeped in sort of fascist history.
And like, you wouldn't even necessarily know
that
it's Mussolini and fascist connected unless you kind of knew about it already. And it is really amazing that so much of it is still intact.
Yeah.
It's because by the end, Italians fucking hated him.
Yeah.
You know, they lynched him. But there are still a lot of physical, visual
remnants,
imprints of Mussolini in the fascist reign of Italy. And one of those is Foro Mussolini, which today is known as Foro Italico. And you can still go there today. If you go to Rome, I highly recommend it. It's a trip. So Foro Mussolini was constructed to be like a sports city. And Mussolini, like many dictators, really put a lot into the youth of the country. So Italian youth would be the future fascists, and their education as well as physical like prowess, you know, physical training, being fit, being strong, was deemed very important. So he built this complex to really facilitate this future generation of fascists. So there were stadiums, there were pools, there were tracks, and
you can still go to those today.
They're
very open.
Very open.
Yeah. You can see people swimming in those pools.
It's wild.
It's crazy.
It's so weird.
It's the strangest place. It's straight out of like
another
time.
You feel like
time.
You're in the Twilight Zone or something.
Because it's so normal just outside of it. And as soon as you go in, it's very like
1940s. Exactly.
Yeah.
And like there's one, the Stadium of the Marbles. And it's like it's a track. And then it's the seats as well as statues are all built of Carrara marble. And each statue is like a male idealized version of the different provinces in Italy. And it's this weird like hybrid combination of like ancient Roman, ancient Greek kind of visual rhetoric with like, oh, but hey, it's like fascist too.
Yeah. And then leading up into that area, especially where like that Olympic stadium was, you see all these sort of fascist mosaics.
Yeah.
Which are
Piazzale dell'Impero.
Yeah. Very weird.
Yeah.
So strange. There's just like these, you have this like mosaic tradition.
Right.
Going back thousands of years.
Right.
But the imagery of fascist.
Right. Right.
Fascist related to sports, related to identity, related to political regime.
Right. Exactly. And it's all interconnected to kind of create this architectural space. And like when you think of architecture, it's not just buildings. It's also like the outdoor constructed space.
And in many cases, this is constructed in a way that is meant to, like, educate, but also to control. So this is really, like, power at work, where it's selecting specific kind imagery. Of visual imagery from, like, the past, but also implementing, like, the goals of fascism, where it's, like, you're very fit and you're very loyal and you're aggressive and you can fight. And you also are aware of your, like, great past of the ancient Romans. And it's all kind of living and breathing in this space, which, you know, is, again, meant to control. It's meant to facilitate the action that, like, Mussolini and the fascists wanted for future Italians. And so this is just one of the examples. And, you know, like, the mosaics that Christina was talking about, like, in it's like in a little piazza, mm-hmm. and they're still there today. And at the entrance of this piazza, there's an obelisk, and it's like, again, an obelisk, and I'll talk about this more in another episode another time, because obelisk, there's a lot to say about it, but it's originally ancient Egyptian, and then the Romans, when they conquered ancient Egypt, would bring obelisks back to Rome. And so Mussolini had his own obelisk constructed, and it's, you know, it's an obelisk, but it's also a little bit different. Like, it doesn't have that typical look of
your typical
Egyptian obelisk, yeah. but it's still kind of like laying claim to this imperial ancient past, but also putting his own touch on it. I mean, it's literally carved into the side is the leader in Latin. So it's making this, like, very phallic statement of, like, hey, I'm here, I'm the man, and this is, like, using the same kind of status symbol that Roman emperors used, mm-hmm. who took it from pharaohs. And so it's all this kind of, like, recycling of different ways of implementing power visually. And, you know, like, in this piazza, like, they had, like, literal stone tablets around it that would mark significant events during the fascist revolution. I said that, and I did air quotes, because a lot of people don't really consider it to be a revolution. But so they had those, and then amazingly enough, after Mussolini fell and was killed, they had, like, stone tablets that were blank. So, you know, they were, like, built and reserved for, like, future great, you know, events in fascist mm-hmm. history. And they actually used those to record the downfall fascist of Mussolini. History. Yeah. So that's how, like, some of these things are still in existence. And, like, even the obelisk itself, it's always, like, has graffiti on it and shit. You know, it's just, it's not the same. But it's still there. It's still there, and it's really interesting to see.
It's definitely worth the trip, and it's not, yeah. it's definitely one of those, like, out-of-the-way, not-typical tourist places. Yes. But very, very much worth
yeah.
it.
Yeah. No, 100%. Yeah. It's just so interesting yeah. to, like, walk through there.
And to see people still exercising in
there. And they had the Olympics there in the 60s.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
Like, what? Yeah. Why? What? But one more site that I'll talk about that Mussolini had constructed is EUR, which is kind of like, it's a weird blend. So it was, like, built under this, like, university project. And it was also meant to be, like, a metropolis. And so this was built in an area that was, like, a swamp. It was a malaria-infested, nasty, nasty swamp. Mm. And when I was reading about this and when I first heard about it, I couldn't help but connect it to, like, Louis XIV and building Versailles, because yeah. it was the same kind of condition. And so this is just
reclaiming the land.
It's reclaiming the land. It's demonstrating your dominance over nature and how architecture and where you choose to build can be so important to, like, recognize and just be like, wow, like, this person had the idea to build in a place that was deemed impossible or impractical, and how that is such a conscious choice. And so it's the same thing with Mussolini deciding to build this metropolis there. And, you know, it was built as a part of the 20th anniversary of when Mussolini and the fascists marched on Rome and kind of rose to power. And it stands for the Esposizione Universale di Roma. And one of the
most. Say that again, Jenny.
Stop.
Say
it.
That one more.
No,
time.
No, no. And the most significant building in the EUR, and the one that I'm just the only one I'm going to really talk about, is the Square Colosseum, and it's got like a full name. It's the Palazzo della Civiltà Italiana, and it's a really, really weird building. And again, it shows this weird ass fascist architecture style where it's like a blend of modern architecture and ancient architecture. Ancient architecture mostly because it's multiple levels of arches, much like the Colosseum. Where it's different is that it's a square and it's all white, so it's Carrara marble, so it's this really imposing white kind of weird fucking looking building.
It just screams of fascism. Like, you look at it and you're like, yeah.
That's
it,
fascist.
Yeah, that's definitely fascist.
It's imposing. Like, it's like domineering.
Think,
it's
when you think fascist, the image in your mind.
Probably
that's,
that building.
That's probably that building. That's what it is.
I do think of Mussolini. I do. I think of him and I think of his little short body and...
concrete-y architecture.
Concrete architecture. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's he did a good job. He did a good job of branding himself.
Yeah,
good job, Il Duce.
Hashtag
yes. Il Duce.
Hashtag Il Duce.
Oh
man,
maybe we shouldn't hashtag that.
No, yeah. Let's not.
Let's not.
Someone weird, awful stuff's gonna come up.
Twitter account under Il Duce with quotes from Il Duce.
Oh,
kind of baiting Trump to retweet.
Yeah,
quotes
it
from
worked,
him.
Didn't it?
It did. And the quote was like, it's better to live one day as a lion than like 100 as a sheep or something like that. And Trump retweeted it.
Oh, man.
I digress.
God damn it.
So the last thing. So on this Square Colosseum, inscripted in Latin is the quote, a people of poets, artists, saints, thinkers, scientists, sailors, explorers. So this is literally labeling Italy as like the cradle of all that is good and intellectual and brave and kind of any kind of impact on humanity. So it just really shows like the ultimate hubris of Mussolini and the fascist regime as like really feeling entitled to this greatness because of the past and not so much because of what was actually present at the time, because literally the fascists were not like contributing great things to the world of art and history and politics. You know, a lot of horrible things happened under the fascist regime, but there is this sense of like entitlement, and of course race incorporates into that. You know, you have all these white structures and like these statues, white marble sculptures of all the, or you know, the different regions in Italy, and it's, you know, it's all just kind of orchestrated under this umbrella of like racial power and dominance.
I also liked it was in that documentary that the BBC documentary. I loved the
Dr. James Fox. Love you.
He's the cutest. There's a great BBC documentary that we used for research for this episode that will be on our sources. But when he's talking about Mussolini, he phrased it perfectly. He was like, Mussolini decided that they were Aryan.
He just decided that
they were white.
And that was like a lot of his thing, because in the beginning, Mussolini didn't even have a problem with Jewish people. And then it was kind of like, oh, like this guy Hitler is picking up momentum and I feel competitive with him. So yeah, actually, I don't like Jewish people either. I mean, he was full of shit.
What a loser.
Yeah.
But,
selective racism.
Yeah. But the architecture still stands, and I think it just reminds us to look at constructed spaces, because every architectural space that you're in, no matter if it's political or educational or whatever, it's constructed with a meaning behind it. Like it wants to kind of generate a certain reaction or experience, and to really be mindful of that. And I think it also can just say safely, like, when someone is trying to bring in elements of the past and talking about this kind of rebirth of greatness of the past, we should be nervous.
Oh, Jenny, I love it.
That,
love it.
That was very subtle.
So, yes. Thank you.
Damn it.
And come again.
I'm, like, her biggest fan, you guys.
I think we're all each other's biggest fans.
It's true. I know. That's real.
Thanks,
and God damn it. I just really appreciate when you guys get going on, like, a thing that you're really excited about. It just makes me so happy to know you. And I'm kind of drunk, you know, and I'm getting emotional.
Hey, we're happy to know you too,
babe. Oh, baby. God. You guys. So, I think we're going to shift gears a little bit here, and not in any sort of expected way, but I think that it's kind of fun to consider a non-Western approach to architecture and power, and to have this discussion, I am here with my lovely Christina. And okay,
I have a mouthful of goat cheese.
I'm kind of obsessed with the goat cheese too.
I'm gonna get some of that.
Get it. It's very good. Wait, that's my wine.
Oh, no, that's fine.
So I'm here with Christina, and I also have to say, I didn't realize I was doing this, but I kind of leave Natalie out, and I didn't mean to, but Natalie is also Mexican.
Yes, I am.
Racist as hell. I can't believe I said that.
I can't do the yell.
No, I can't do
it's
like
very
a,
difficult.
Okay,
to do. I just tried.
All right, you know what? Before I get like into this, can I just say to my Mexican listeners out there, rest in peace, Juan Gabriel.
Ay, Juan.
El Divo. Okay. I miss him already. He was out there. Who remembers that novella when we were kids? Remember that novela?
No.
And the song was like, Abrázame muy fuerte, amor, porque el tiempo se vaya. Oh, wait, you took my wine away again, girl.
No, that's mine.
Wait, what? One of these is mine. I think.
No.
Yeah, it might be yours. I'll just take this one.
So, it's okay. We're fine here. We're okay with sharing.
We all know each other.
So.
You get one of those pens.
Anyway, that was very much off topic, but back on topic, we're going to have a little discussion about some architecture in Mexico that really is interesting.
It speaks to our soul.
So
deep down.
You know, today's topic, the last episode and this episode are on architecture and power. And it's very interesting to discuss what's been going on in Mexico City for the last like 600 years, mm-hmm. right? Okay. So to put it in context, we're going to discuss the Palacio Nacional, or the National Palace.
In English.
In English.
Thanks.
You're welcome. So, the Palacio is located in Mexico City's main square. It's called the Plaza de la Constitución, or El Zócalo. I don't call it.
Zócalo. I mean,
People call it Zócalo. So the Zócalo is really popular, and the reason why is because every year, on just before 11 p.m. on September 15th, the president of Mexico gives El Grito. All right.
El Grito.
Do you know about the Grito? What? Have you been there for the Grito?
I've never been there for the Grito.
I've never been to Mexico City for the Grito.
But you hear about it.
But I was in Culiacan a couple years ago for the Grito, and Culiacan is on the west coast, northwestern coast of Mexico. September 15th is Mexican Independence Day.
September 16th.
Worst Mexican ever. So September 16th is Mexican Independence Day. That is when Mexico said, fuck you, Spain, like, we're free. And on that day, in the tradition of Father Miguel Hidalgo, we go out into the street, we get real fucking drunk, and we scream. You literally just go, like, ah!
That's what El Grito means in English. It's the scream.
Grito means scream.
Yeah. Ah.
So on September 15th, right before midnight, the president of Mexico goes out into, okay, so the Palacio is in this big, huge courtyard. It's called El Zócalo, and he goes out onto the balcony,
and he does his whole thing. And it's really cool. It's a ceremony. You ring the bell that hangs on the balcony. The bell is the original bell that Father Miguel Hidalgo rang to call for the rebellion against Spain, okay? And it originally was hung in the church of Dolores Hidalgo in Guanajuato, but it was located to Mexico City. Real interesting. All right, the bell has the Mexican coat of arms, which is the Aztec Eagle Knight and his Spanish counterpart. And these were so interesting. And it's just one example of several instances of synthesis between
Indigenous traditions and
European traditions. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's literally Mexico, okay? So, the Palacio. It's huge. It's a palace. Yeah. It's literally a palace. And it is...
high security. This give your passport over when you go in. Go through a metal detector. Really? Oh, yeah. It is a serious place.
Damn.
It's a really important place. It houses the National Archives.
Sure.
It houses, like, the...
place of, like, where they wrote the Constitution and all of this stuff. Yeah. And for art history lovers, it houses a lot of Diego Rivera murals.
Oh, my God.
Which are the most beautiful.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It makes me so excited.
What did you say last time you were like, I love that fat bastard? Was that what you said?
Fat piece of shit.
Fat piece of shit.
He was. And I love him very much. But he was not a good man. But you know what? We're going to have a conversation about Diego in another episode. Because I have a lot to say about him. I know a lot about his life. He's like a brother to me.
Piece of shit, brother.
Yeah.
That's what you think of your brothers as.
Apparently, I have a lot of terrible things to say about my brothers. But back to the palace. So, the palace, the facade, is made out of a type of volcanic rock called Tezontle.
Cool.
Okay. This rock is a porous, highly oxidized volcanic rock. It's red in color, and that's due to the iron oxide. This is significant for two reasons. A, Mexico City is in a valley, and it's a volcanic valley, and there are many volcanoes, and many of them are still active. There's two really famous ones that are active. I'm not going to try to pronounce them right now. What is it? Popocatépetl or something? I don't speak...
Aztec names are very
It's
hard.
Nahual. I don't speak Nahual. Me. It's very hard. It's very complicated. Hard to pronounce.
Is that like...
a lot of consonants. Yeah.
That's what the natives say.
Yeah.
So, anyways, what's really interesting about the palace is its location. So, the very center of Mexico City houses El Templo Mayor,
which is the most coolest place ever. If you ever had a chance to go to Mexico City, go there.
Okay.
Wonderful ruins and a wonderful museum.
They're not even ruined. They're like perfect.
They're perfect. And they also have a wonderful museum attached to it. It's amazing.
It's seriously amazing. Mexico City is one of the most amazing places in the world. I highly suggest going there as soon as possible because it is sinking as we speak.
Oh!
Yeah, Mexico City, the Aztecs, before they were Aztecs, when they were still wandering nomads, had a vision. And the vision was that they would wander until they found an eagle perched atop a cactus, devouring a snake. And where they would find this eagle determined where they were going to build their city center. And they found the eagle. And they found the eagle in the middle of a swamp. And they said,
swamps! What's up with building in swamps?
What's up with that? Here we go.
Rome was built on a swamp.
They built it on a goddamn swamp. And, which is fine because, you know, when you see old representations of what the Aztec city center, it was named Tenochtitlan.
See, that word is really hard for me to say.
It's hard to say, yes.
It is a difficult word.
It's Tenochtitlan. And Tenochtitlan was literally a city center built upon lagoons, and there were a series of canals connected various parts of the city, and that is what Mexico City present day was built upon, which is very interesting because modern day Mexico has never in any way, shape, or form really divorced themselves of their indigenous identity. And you see this in the Palacio because the Palacio, before it was known as the Palacio, was actually known as Moctezuma's new houses. Okay.
Whoa.
Yeah, really interesting. So Moctezuma II was the last great ruler of the Aztec Empire before the subjugation of the native peoples by Cortez and his men from Spain and their disgusting syphilis and their smallpox and all the disgusting shit that they brought over from their dirty ass European waves. Dicks. Dirty European dicks came over and ruined everything. But let's just get one thing straight, though, as far as, here's the thing. Yes, the Europeans came over and fucked everything up in a really major way, but the Aztecs were in no way, shape, or form little innocent natives. This is, like, so, I'm, like, gonna just barely touch on this, but there's this idea of the noble savage that is extolled by, problematic, Europeans, and a lot of people, I think about that when they think about what the native...
Yeah, Corey just whispered Pocahontas.
Yeah! So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that the Aztecs were brutal motherfuckers, and they were very, they were a war-faring people, and you know, honestly, they would have taken over all of North America, honestly, before the Spanish came over. I digress. What really is of importance here is that the area that is now known as the Palacio was the center of the government of the Aztec people, and it's very interesting because at the time before the Spanish came over, the palace functioned as the Aztec Tlatoani's residence. So the Tlatoani, Tlatoani, what it translates to is like noble people, okay? And it was, the Tlatoani were the people who were in charge of official functions. They were basically high government officials. And so the palaces were divided into two sections. There were, there was the main facade, there was marble, there was painted stucco, there was a shield of the monarchy, an eagle with a snake in its claws. And it was a very interesting place. There was, the inside had three patios surrounded by porticos, which is, porticos are a series of columns.
Yes.
Columns. And we know about porticos most famously from our Greek friends.
Roman friends.
I'm sorry.
Roman friends.
My bad. There was indoor sanitary facilities, fountains, gardens. There were bedrooms with tapestries of cotton, feathers, rabbit fur, painted in bright colors.
Beautiful.
Oh, so lovely.
Luxurious.
It was definitely luxurious.
Hold on a second.
It
rabbit
was, I know, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Triggered.
I feel like this is a good time to address this because we've never said this before. As you know, our logo is a bunny.
Oh, we haven't shown him.
Shit.
It's a bunny drinking out of a wine glass. And that's
a real bun.
He's a real bun, and he's our little mascot. And we're going to post pictures of him like on our Instagram.
Yeah, we will.
He's my bun, and he is our number one fan.
He's a good patron boy.
He's such a good boy. And so what I'm trying to say is...
say no to rabbit fur.
Thank you. Okay. Continue.
I will continue. So basically what happened was when Cortez showed up, he saw this luxurious palace, and he said, what the fuck? What are these people doing out here? Wow, they're rich. And he was so surprised that he immediately relayed letters to Charles I in Spain and said, yo,
you gotta get
Carlos, it's lit out here. They got gold, they got fur, they got feathers. We need to subdue these people ASAP. And that's essentially what happened. So Cortez shows up, everything gets fucked up. The houses of Moctezuma were not destroyed, but they were basically rendered completely in, what is that word? In
Uninhabitable?
Uninhabitable. Thank you. God damn.
good thing
I was going to say inebriated.
So. Yes, they were rendered inebriated.
Words are hard sometimes.
Words are hard. And so essentially these palaces went from being Aztec palaces to ruins to, okay, now we have all this raw material. Let's build a Baroque palace. And that's what the Spanish did. Ooh, girl. Corey's checking her Snapchat.
Yeah, I got a Frank Ocean snap. Have you guys heard the new Frank Ocean?
Wait, can we talk about it in like a second?
Yes.
Yeah, let's talk about it in a second.
Okay.
I'm gone. In 1562, the Spanish crown bought the palace and the land for Martin Cortez, who was the son of Hernan Cortez. And that's not very interesting information. All it means is that it ceased to be the seat of the Aztec royal empire. It went from Cortez into the Spanish royal crown, and it stayed that way for a long time, into the 1830s. And in the 1830s, this palace all of a sudden became a hot seat of revolution. Because the Mexican people were sick of it. They were sick of being the viceroy of the Spanish. And there was real revolution. And it was great. And honestly, this could really be like a very interesting episode. The Spanish, the Mexican Revolution. There's so much to be said. There's so much art that came out of it. The Mexican Revolution, there's two of them. Okay, the Mexican Revolution from Spain, and then the Mexican Revolution from itself. And that's essentially where we start to see the most famous art. So Mexico had a revolution. Immediately after they emancipated themselves from Spain, suddenly they found themselves in a 30-year-long dictatorship at the hands of Porfirio Diaz.
God damn it! Yes.
Interesting fact, my mother's uncle or cousin or somebody related
Someone.
To me served in his army.
Whoa! Oh,
in his army? Not against him?
No, in his.
Traitor! But this get the fuck out.
But we were rural Mexicans living a rural life.
No, you know what? Yeah. And
you were an honest people.
We were honest, good earth people.
good earth. But you know what? Like, it's, you know, I'll forgive it because it was 150 years ago.
It was a long time ago.
But, you know, so there was the war for independence from Spain, and then Mexico was immediately entrenched in a dictatorship. And the dictatorship was really horrible, and it resulted in what is kind of happening right now in the United States, but not so bad, where there's an extreme disparity between the rich and the poor, and the poor are sick of it, and they're tired, and they're hungry. And so around 1910, there was some chaos, and the war for the Mexican Revolution kicked off. And around that time is when, once again, we see a change of ownership, essentially, of the Palacio. So the Palacio went from being the seat of the viceroy to becoming the center of government for the newly democratic Mexican government, which is what we know today to be the most current government. And what's wonderful is that the Palacio is the home to several beautiful, absolutely breathtaking murals by not only Diego Rivera, but also Orozco.
Yes.
Ooh, yeah. Orozco.
I love him. Oh, I love him.
That place is one magical
it's
place.
Beautiful. Please go to Mexico City and go to the Palacio Nacional and check it out, you guys.
It is worth it.
It is so good. It's really, really good. And the point of this whole long-ass story is that this area in Mexico City, and this palace in particular, has changed throughout time, it's been the seat of several different power structures, ranging from non-Western indigenous Aztec to Spanish to dictator Criollo, which are the white Mexicans of European descent, into finally the seat of government to the Democratic Mexican Republic. And as we speak, we could say that Mexico may be going through yet another power shift because I don't know how many people out there are keeping up with what's going on in Mexico, but it's a real shit show down there. it's a seat of corruption. The Mexican government is completely run and owned by the cartels, and the president, Peña Nieto, is a piece of shit, and he's a puppet to the cartels, and that's what's kind of going on right now. And I have a feeling that within the next few years, I think there's going to be some major revolution in Mexico. I think it's starting now, for sure. Mexico is about due for a revolution every 100 years, just about. And I think that they're coming around. I think it's going to happen, and I'm excited because you know what? I have family down there. I've seen the violence firsthand of what the cartels are doing, and it's really scary, and nobody is happy about it. So I can't wait to see who is going to run the Palacio next. So that's all I got, you guys.
That's a good amount.
Architecture.
This is a solid amount of stuff. So we're going to move on to listener mail, finish things up. So, we've got a message from John.
John.
Just a hello and thanks. Got into your cast a few weeks ago, and now I can't wait for the next ones to come up. Such a refreshing change from the usual boring stuff, but still super educational. I've learned a lot, especially the color theory episodes. Here's to a lot more of your laughter. Thanks so much.
Oh, John. So what a sweet baby. It is. Angel.
It's very sweet because we love to laugh and we're so glad you enjoy our laughter.
Appreciate our lack of seriousness, but also our intense seriousness.
It comes in waves.
Combination. Yeah. I love that people sense it and that they appreciate it.
Yeah,
it
definitely.
Really happy.
Because we're all very passionate, but we also like to have a good time. So we're glad you're enjoying it.
So true.
We're glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
Like many people have said before, you like the color theory episodes. A lot of people really liked those. So to kind of continue in...
Should we sing Purple Rain again?
Yeah.
No, that was a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Your harmonies were on point.
No, we're not going to sing it until the next episode.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we should wait.
Hold on to your hat.
Yeah.
Jenny and I are going to just sing our hearts out.
Because our next episode, we're going to, throughout the next year or so, sprinkle some specific episodes on specific colors.
Yes. We'll sprinkle just, it.
And our next episode after this one is going to be on the color purple.
Woo!
So if you want to learn more about purple, the history, the craziness behind it, stay tuned, my friends.
Yeah, you know, and I just want to say something really quick. Every listener mail that we've gotten makes a comment about, like, wow, you guys are making art history not boring. And, you know, I understand that there's, like, the stereotype that art history is so boring, and I am so happy if we are somehow challenging that.
Yeah, because it's so fun.
I don't think it's boring. I've never in my life been like, oh, this is so boring. And the fact that our discipline is this thing that's stereotypically boring.
Yeah.
Makes me crazy. Like, I just don't understand.
We're very glad that you think we make it interesting, because we obviously love it and find it interesting.
This is a call to all art history professors and TAs
make
and teachers.
Make it fun!
Be interesting,
come
please.
Come on!
Get drunk before class.
It's an interesting topic.
Take wine to class!
Act accordingly.
Yeah, so thank you once again. We love getting listener mail. If you would like to send us listener mail, and even not just like, I mean, we love getting compliments and stuff, but if you have a question or would like to start a discussion about anything we talk about, we'd love that. Like, please send us your questions. Like, that would be fantastic. arthistorybabes@gmail.com, Twitter @arthistorybabes, Instagram, Art History Vibes Podcast. ArtHistoryVibes.com is our website where you'll find our sources and images. Like us on Facebook. And if you really want to help us out, we super appreciate it. Write a review for us on iTunes and get some traffic going in our reviews. Yeah. The ones we've gotten so far have been amazing, so thank you so much. But yeah, thank you for listening.
Thanks for joining us on the love of architecture. Keep thinking about it.
There's so much to
think
about.
It's cool.
We love it.
Keep living in buildings.
Yeah, we're all about the buildings.
Keep going to buildings and maybe think about
them. Be critical.
Think about power when you're looking at them.
When you go to a building, think about power.
Yeah.
Think about it.
But thanks again. Peace out.
You're beautiful.
From Cast.